Mr. Ford.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Matt Ford, and along with David Rontel, I appear before this Court pursuant to a 7-Eleven license on behalf of Northwestern University's Bloom Legal Clinic. I'll first be addressing the denial of an entrapment instruction at the District Court and the government's cross-appeal as to drug amount. Mr. Rontel will then be discussing the remaining sentencing issues, and unless this Court has any further questions, we wish to rest on our briefs as to the insufficiency of the evidence. The District Court erred when it denied Mr. Millett's request for an entrapment instruction. This Court examines the District Court's denial of an instruction, de novo, and entrapment in light of two elements, government inducement and the defendant's predisposition. In our briefs, we've gone through both of these factors, as well as the five factors indicative of predisposition. We wanted to take the time today to point out how these factors played out at three specific points in the sting itself. In short, although Mr. Millett was predisposed to commit a robbery of drug dealers' cash, the government structured a robbery that involved both the theft of cash and drugs.
Did Mr. Millett express any reluctance to Gooden's request to expand the conspiracy to include the theft of the drugs?
Well, Your Honor, he did. After Mr. Gooden initially kicked off the sting, Mr. Millett stated, and Harvey Gooden asked whether what was to come of any drugs. Mr. Millett said, in effect, we don't mess with that. That's not our business. That's your expertise. And Gooden followed up by asking, well, if there's some residual amount remaining, I could sell that off, and that could be additional profits. In addition to this expression of reluctance, the government kept the inducement going throughout the rest of the sting by continuing to
Millett didn't say, no, I don't want to be involved in this robbery if it's going to include the theft of drugs.
No, Your Honor, well, that's true. At first, he did express stating that generally he did not was not involved in drug distribution. However, in this case, the nature of there are two factors that we think are helped to deflect that fact somewhat. The first is that Mr. Millett was not – there was no indication that he had been involved in a drug distribution conspiracy prior to the government's initiation of the sting. And second, the amount to be had in this particular
– That puzzles me. His business was robbing drug dealers.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Your Honor.
Right? And something happens to the drugs. It seems to me your position is that a deal, I take cash, you take drugs, is not a conspiracy to distribute drugs, but it seems to me it plainly is.
Well, Your Honor,
that's all that's needed for guilt, as described. I take the cash, you take the drugs.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think that would be a, as to the insufficiency of the evidence point, I think the record may reflect that, but in terms of entrapment,
that's his business. How can there be any lack of predisposition?
Well, Your Honor, that's a good question. The line that we're asking this court to draw is simply based on the evidence that the government had before it at the beginning of the sting, which consisted of three things: two statements by Mr. Millett that he had robbed a drug dealer's bagman before of their cash. There's a statement during cross-examination by the government's informant that Harvey Gooden had never heard that Mr. Millett had stolen drugs before. In addition, the government, the FBI agent on cross said that he had no reason to think that aside from the fact that the object of the robbery was a drug dealer, that Mr. Millett was involved in drugs at all. And at trial and throughout, Mr. Millett has stated,
I robbed cash. It's not my question. Suppose Millett, for his entire life, had set up 10 transactions, and the term of every one of them was, I'll take the drug dealer's cash, and you, whoever's helping me, whether they be corrupt police officers or informants or whoever else, you can take his inventory. And Millett has never in his life touched drugs. Isn't it true that on those transactions, as I've described it, he's participated in a conspiracy to distribute drugs?
Your Honor, I think those facts stand. The short answer is yes, but those facts are not what.
That's his norm. If that's what's going on, then I'm puzzled by the claim that there isn't plenty of evidence of predisposition.
Your Honor, again, based on the hypothetical, the facts that you've given me, I would agree. However, the record available to the government prior to the sting did not have the element of Mr. Millett saying, you take the drugs, I'll take the cash. That was, as far as the record shows, and as was elicited at trial, not what Mr. Millett did before.
Don't just vanish. He's getting these corrupt police officers to help him. They're being compensated. And his fair inference is they're being compensated in kind.
Yes, Your Honor. However, we don't have evidence of that prior to the initial robbery in this case. It was simply that Mr. Millett had been involved in the theft of a drug dealer's bagman. He specifically told the government's informant that he had a friend who would identify the bagman, which were those people working with the drug dealers that would have their cash as opposed to their drug supply. And again, on the hypothetical posited, I believe that that's a different case. However, in this instance, the government only knew that he had targeted sort of the banks for the drug dealers and not their supply of drugs. And in addition, it knew that Mr. Millett was cozying up to a drug dealer. Its informant was, for some time, Mr. Millett's drug dealer. And despite having ostensibly access to a means for redistributing drugs, Mr. Millett never availed himself of that opportunity. So while, yes, he had been involved in the past in this type of robbery, and if they had involved some sort of prior agreement, it would be a logical inference to include drugs. However, in this case, the government simply did not have that and instead structured a qualitatively different crime. If this court has no further questions, I'd like to turn things over to Mr. Lontell for sentencing issues.
Certainly, Mr. Ford. Mr. Rontel.
Good morning. The district court erred three times in sentencing Mr. Millett. First, the district court erred in failing to properly apply the mandatory factors set forth in 3553A. Second, the district court misinterpreted the role enhancement provision 3B1.1 in assessing Mr. Millett a 4 versus 2 or 3 level enhancement. Finally, the district court erred in failing to provide Mr. Millett with the safety valve relief. On this last issue, we wish to rest on our briefs. Returning to the first issue, the district court in its application of the 3553A factors engaged in two procedural and two substantive errors, all of which rendered Mr. Millett's sentence unreasonable. With respect to the procedural errors, the district court first did not address any of the 3553A factors except for computing a guideline sentence under 3553A4.
But didn't the court express concern? First of all, our case law is pretty clear. You don't have to go bullet by bullet. You agree with that?
We agree with that.
And the court expressed concern about his history and his attitude and mentioned the whole issue of sentencing manipulation, that possibility by the government. So he indeed addressed the factors or a couple of the factors generally. And couldn't that history include a lot of what's spelled out in 3553A?
We don't agree with that, Your Honor, because we believe that the district court in this case viewed those considerations through the lens of the guidelines. There's explicit references throughout the sentencing transcript that the district court had to do what he had to do because the guidelines told him what to do. And so, therefore, with respect to the physical impairment, dire family circumstances, and diminished capacity, the district court used the outdated language of downward departure, then rejected Mr. Millett's claims because he has to do what the guidelines tell him. The district court also improperly rejected Mr. Millett's claim with respect to sentencing manipulation. And although this court does not recognize a sentencing manipulation defense, it has not addressed whether or not sentencing manipulation may be a basis for a non-guideline sentence. This is important because sentencing manipulation goes to the nature and circumstances of the offense under 3553A1. And in this case, although the district court was troubled by this scenario in which the government retained a tremendous amount of control over the instrumentality of the offense and could peg Mr. Millett with whatever it wanted to by placing any amount of drugs in the black duffel, it did not properly vet this concern against the 3553A factors to determine whether a non-guideline sentence was warranted. Moving on, the district court also erred in its interpretation of the role enhancement provision 3B1.1. Because of this misinterpretation, this court should review the district court's errors de novo. As an initial matter, the district court failed to provide on the record adequate reasons as to why Mr. Millett deserved the 4-level enhancement. For practical considerations, not only does this put the defendant on notice of what conduct was warranted for the 4-level enhancement, but helps to facilitate appellate review as this court need not set sail on a fishing expedition through the record to determine why the district court applied the 4-level enhancement. At sentencing, Mr. Millett offered the district court an opportunity to distinguish between the 4, 3, and 2-level enhancements. The district court rejected this and did not even assess any reason as to why Mr. Millett deserve the four-level enhancement, except that the government had proven the 4 points. We believe that this is a mixed question of fact and law, and therefore this court should review the misinterpretation of the guidelines de novo. But if this court even agrees that...
I don't understand that. As soon as you say it's all mixed up, an ultimate issue, one might say, why doesn't Pullman's standard against Swint demand that we review it deferentially?
Your Honor, I'm not aware of Pullman, but I would say this, that if this court does determine...
It's merely the controlling decision of the Supreme Court on how one addresses mixed questions of law and fact.
Well, I think we're arguing that the factual predicates of the 3- and 4-level enhancement are identical, and so in its choice of the 3- or 4-level enhancement, the district court is interpreting the guidelines and therefore making a legal conclusion.
That's the kind of thing that the Fifth Circuit said in Pullman. They got reversed 9-0.
Like I said, Your Honor, I'm unaware with that decision, but I'd be happy to file a supplemental brief on the issue.
Need supplemental briefs on it.
But for these reasons, this court should vacate this portion of Mr. Millett's sentence and remand with an instruction for the imposition of no more than the 2- or 3-level adjustment. And if there are no further questions, Your Honors, I'd like to reserve the remainder of our time for rebuttal.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Certainly, counsel. Mr. Langer.
May it please the court, my name is Ben Langner, and I represent the United States in this case. The first issue that I'd like to address is the entrapment instruction with respect to counts 1 and 2. In order to warrant an entrapment instruction, the defendant was required to come forward with evidence of 2 things, a lack of predisposition to commit the crime charged and government inducement that caused him to commit the crime charged. The defendant in this case failed to satisfy either prong. The defendant seems to concede, in fact, in his argument today, specifically said that he was predisposed to commit an armed robbery of a drug dealer. He contends, however, that there's a distinction between his predisposition to rob a drug dealer of drugs and his predisposition to rob the drug dealer of money. This position was rightfully rejected by the district court for several reasons. In the jury instructions related to entrapment, the Seventh Circuit instructions, they specifically say that with respect to entrapment, the central question is whether the defendant showed reluctance to engage in criminal activity that was overcome by inducement or persuasion. Here, there is no evidence anywhere in the record of any sort of reluctance to commit the crime, and specifically any reluctance to separate the armed robbery of drugs from the armed robbery of money. In fact, the evidence that was shown at trial, in fact, showed that he was predisposed to take the drugs. Specifically, the taped conversations between the defendant and Harvey Gooden, who he believed was his co-conspirator at the time.
Counsel, an entrapment instruction was given on the firearms offense, is that correct?
That's correct.
And there was an acquittal on that offense.
That's true.
Should that give us any concern?
No, really the two offenses were very separate. The firearm crime committed was sort of after the fact. It was after this crime was done and finished, the co-conspirator or the supposed co-conspirator, Harvey Gooden, approached the defendant and said that he needed a firearm in order to protect himself. There was a whole separate set of facts that dealt with what was going on there. And in the end, this is a factual determination that the court made here. So they really are very separate. The taped conversations between the defendant and Harvey Gooden here were very explicit. You know, first of all, obviously, this is the robbery of a drug dealer, and as the court has pointed out, that carries with it the fair possibility that the robbery is going to involve both drugs and money. So during this conversation, Harvey Gooden raises the question, what are we going to do with any drugs that are on the drug dealer when we rob him? And the defendant was clear in that instance and clear throughout, not only the planning of the robbery, but also the carrying out of the robbery, that any drugs that were there, they intended to take. In his, I think that it was phrased as a, you know, it wasn't his expertise to do anything with the drugs. That's not a reluctance to steal the drugs. That's just a reluctance to, you know, be the one who actually disposes of the drugs. The bottom line is there was no reluctance for him to take those drugs. He just intended to give them to Harvey Gooden to go ahead and sell.
Was there evidence that the proceeds from the sale of the drugs was to be split?
It's not clear specifically in the record as to how the exact proceeds of that were going to be handled. I know that the defendant, in the course of planning the robbery, would say, I know that you have to put some in your pocket. I know that this is going to be, you know, part of your sort of fee for bringing this crime to my attention. So there certainly was a benefit redounding to the defendant in Mr. Gooden being able to sell these drugs. As to whether part of that money would be eventually given back, that isn't clear. I know that there also, in the course of committing this crime, was some indication that the, and this is sort of, I know was taken out a number of points, but there is some indication of it, that the actual thing that they were trying to do was dealt with the bribery of a judge. And I think that some of this money was intended to be given directly to the defendant so that he could arrange for the bribery of this judge. So we have no statements anywhere in the record in this case indicating that the defendant perceived any distinction between the robbery of drugs and the robbery of money. There's no reluctance. There's no hesitation. With respect to inducement, the defendant also can't show that he was induced into committing this crime. The focus of this prong is on whether the government offered some extraordinary inducement that caused that overcame the defendant's reluctance and caused him to commit a crime that he otherwise would not have committed.
Well, given the amount of drugs the informant said was in question, I mean, wasn't there an inducement to him to reap extraordinary gains in terms of the dollars that were involved?
Well, what's interesting here is that the defendant, and the defendant testified in this trial. He testified for a long time, and he made a number of statements to try and exculpate himself. And never once during that entire testimony did he ever say that he committed this crime because of any inducement the government was offering. And in fact, what we do know is that the defendant committed several, armed robberies of drug dealers in the past. And, at no point was there any indication that he needed any sort of special inducement to engage in a crime like this. And he never once at trial said that this is the reason I was doing this because it was so overwhelming, the money that I could make. And specifically, the way that he's tried to subdivide this and say that, I was entrapped into taking the drugs as opposed to the money, there's no indication that there was any inducement to take that extra step and take the drugs as opposed to taking the money. What's clear here is that the defendant's argument at trial was not really based on entrapment. It was based on intent. What he's trying to say is, I didn't want to join an agreement to take the drugs. But the judge, in fact, in this case, allowed him to argue this in terms of intent. He just didn't allow him to argue entrapment. Now, the second issue that was addressed, one of the additional issues, dealt with the enhancement for role in the offense. With respect to the standard of review on that particular issue, the defendant cites the United States versus DiCicco, and I'm probably butchering the pronunciation of that that name, for the proposition that this should have been reviewed de novo. The DiCicco case is completely distinguishable from our situation here. There was no factual question whatsoever in DiCicco. Both parties agreed in that case that the defendant had committed the crime, that the defendant had organized individuals who were, participated in some way in the crime. But the question there was whether or not those individuals, everyone had agreed, were not actually criminally responsible for the crime. They were sort of unwary, but they had, helped the defendant do something in the course of the crime. And the question was whether or not under 3B1.1, whether that requires evidence that the people that the defendant organized and led were in fact criminally responsible as opposed to just unwitting actors.
Was there any evidence that the three men who drove up next to the Cadillac were supposed to get a cut of the proceeds?
There is no specific evidence saying what their role was. However, I think it's a fair inference given what was observed by the surveillance agents in this case, where they observed several cars coming into the parking lot and doing counter-surveillance, seeing what's going on. There's three people that drive up in a car. One of them gets out of the back of the car, reaches into the trunk of the car, takes the bag out, and as he's getting back into the car he was in, it starts to take off before he's even in the car. I mean, it's a fair inference that the judge made that these two people are providing some sort of protection, acting as lookouts in some way. Here we only have a factual question. The judge was determining whether or not the defendant was a leader or organizer under 3B1.1, and there was more than sufficient evidence to determine that he was. We know that he recruited Melvin Jones and recruited several other individuals to be a part of this conspiracy to rob this drug dealer. We know that he guided the planning of this robbery, not only with respect to how this was going to be carried out under the guise of police action, but also when it was going to be done, and several other things. He also coordinated the two sides of this conspiracy. We have, on one side, Melvin Jones, who is the corrupt Harvey police officer, who was doing sort of the operational side of this, where he was actually carrying out the robbery. And then we have Harvey Gooden, who was on the other side, providing information to the scheme. And, in fact, Melvin Jones and Harvey Gooden never even met. Their only point of contact was the defendant, who was organizing this, orchestrating it, talking to both sides. This is particularly evident on the day of the robbery, when the defendant was acting as in sort of an operational center. He was receiving phone calls back, relaying information from one side to the other. And also after the robbery, when they had taken this money and supposed drugs from the back of the car, they brought it back to the defendant. He was the one that called Harvey Gooden afterwards and said, you know, these what we thought we had taken that were supposed to be drugs are in fact flour, which shows, I mean, he's receiving, these people are taking the drugs back to him, which, you know, further shows his leadership role here. With respect to the sentencing procedure that was followed, what the court did during the sentencing hearing is essentially it had two parts to the sentencing. The first part of its sentencing hearing, which were pages 9 to 23 of the sentencing transcript, the court considered and dealt with calculating the advisory guideline range. During this first portion of the sentencing hearing, the judge first addressed Mr. Millett's arguments regarding physical impairment, diminished capacity, and family circumstances. The judge addressed those arguments in the context of a motion for downward departure. Now, it's not clear from the record whether any formal motion was made in that regard or whether the judge perceived some comments that were made or something that was written as a motion for downward departure. But nonetheless, he addressed them first in that context, and rightfully so, said that these things are not part of the advisory guideline calculation. I can't consider these here, and he did not do so. Now, in the second part of his sentencing hearing, which is pages 23 to 32, the judge allowed the parties to address any factors that may be relevant to his sentencing, including any of the 3553 factors. During that portion of the sentencing hearing, the defendant again addressed his arguments related to physical impairment, family circumstances, diminished capacity. The judge listened to those arguments, and he, in fact, addressed them in the sentence that he handed down. He ordered substance abuse treatment and mental health treatment. So clearly the judge was aware of these, and he addressed them in his sentence. Again, and also, as the court pointed out, the judge is not required to give a list of every 3553 factor and explain how its relevance came into his sentence. What he did was give a statement that was consistent with 3553 and explained his arguments. The last point that I'd like to address is the government's appeal with respect to the amount of drugs that the district court used when calculating the base offense level. The defendant in his reply brief seems to indicate that this is some sort of factual determination, but there really was no factual basis. What the court did was it said that it was uncomfortable with the government's level of control over this offense, and it was simply going to use the jury minimum Apprendi finding when it was making its calculations.
That's something a judge can do after Booker. And let me be clear about the nature of my inquiry. It's not, is this the way the guidelines provide? Because it surely isn't. The judge didn't make the independent finding. But we know that the judge gave a 97-month sentence, which is the minimum of the range calculated for 500 grams of cocaine. So the judge doesn't indicate any desire to go higher, and under Booker, he has a perfect right to impose a 97-month sentence in this case. The question I'm asking is, who cares whether it was 500 grams or 2 kilograms? The judge has told us he would prefer to be on the low end rather than go up, and given Booker, he can do that.
Well, I think the reason that it's important here is that he's on the low end of I think it was a 32 total offense level. If he would have properly calculated the guideline range, he would have been at the low end of a 34 base offense level.
Give a 97-month sentence. Right. Now, it would have been easier had the district judge said, and look, it doesn't matter whether I use 500 grams or 2 kilograms, I'm giving a 97-month sentence. If he says that, government can't appeal. There's nothing.
Well, the government would certainly have a much harder road in appeal. That is true. And you're right.
Let me take it back. The government can appeal. Anybody can appeal. The government can't win.
Well, that may be, Your Honor, but the point the government's making here is this wasn't the proper procedure to follow, and what the court should have done is calculate the proper guideline range. And you're right, there is room under 3553, certainly, for the court to enter the sentence.
What I'm asking is, isn't that just a total waste of time? If we know that the judge doesn't want to give a higher sentence, he wasn't constrained on the upward end. Right? If the judge had given a sentence at the upward end of the guideline range for 500 grams, then the prosecutor might say, look, this judge thought he was constrained.
Well, I think the concern here,
the judge doesn't appear to want to give a higher sentence.
I understand. And the concern here is not necessarily with the end result, but it's also with what the court is saying, that there was something improper about what the government did here. The government, the 2 kilograms of...
We don't You can't appeal from statements in a transcript. You can only appeal from judgments. And one might incline to think that the only conceivable consequence of this appeal for the prosecutor might be to have the Court of Appeals say what the district court said, because the sentence isn't going up.
Well, ideally, what the Court of Appeals might say is that what the judge's concerns here really have no basis in the facts. What throughout the course of the planning of this robbery and throughout the implementation of this robbery, it was always known that there were going to be drugs involved in the robbery, and it was always known that there were going to be several kilos of cocaine in this robbery. So the concern here is that the judge was under the impression there's something improper in what the government did. And, you know, I think that that's what the government intends to clarify here.
Look, I'm very surprised that the Solicitor General would authorize an appeal if the rationale is, as you now say it, just because the prosecutor doesn't agree with things the district judge said. And things the district judge says in sentencing transcripts have zero precedential effect.
I understand, and that is not the rationale. The rationale is the sentence that was entered here. However, that is another concern, I should say.
But, of course, the guidelines anticipate and actually reaffirm the district court's concern for manipulation, particularly because this is a reverse sting situation.
Well, I think that the court's concern in different facts may have been legitimate, but in the facts here, there's no basis to believe that the government did anything that was different than what was anticipated in the course of the crime. They didn't add on to the amount that was supposed to be in the car. And unless the court has further questions, the government will rely on this.
Except they created the amount that was supposed to be in the car.
They did, correct.
Correct. Okay.
The government will rely on its brief for any remaining points and ask that the court remain the case with instructions to use the amount of drugs that were reasonably foreseeable to the defendant when calculating the base offense level.
Thank you, Mr. Langner. Anything further, Mr. Ford?
Yes. Your Honor, with the time I have remaining, I just want to reiterate that, and I won't belabor the point, however, that the district court sentenced Mr. Millett based on the facts at trial. It restated the facts of the conspiracy on two separate occasions, and it estimated an amount based on the facts that were available to it and in light of its obligation to make conservative estimates when speculating as to drug amount.
I don't understand an obligation to make conservative estimates. We've said in the Spano case that the obligation is to make accurate or unbiased estimates, not the lowest estimate you could make.
That's true, Your Honor. Perhaps obligation is too strong of a word. However, the court has exhorted, maybe to use a lesser word, the district court to make conservative estimates when presented with speculation, particularly in the...
You're not supposed to make conservative estimates. You're supposed to make accurate ones.
Yes, Your Honor.
The proposition, make conservative estimates, is exactly the proposition that was rejected in Spano.
Yes, Your Honor. In particular, I was relying on this court's statement in Henderson, but won't belabor the point. So as a result, the district court's calculation as to drug amount was reasonable. In addition, I'd like to just simply touch upon one issue dealing with Mr. Millett's reluctance to commit the crime and the line separating the theft of drugs and the theft of cash. There is a rational reason why Mr. Millett would have towed this border without actually having passed over it, absent the amount of inducement offered by the government. He had... Just to reiterate, he was a lawyer and was aware of the different interests at stake in the robbery of the two different types of whether cash or drugs. As a result, it would be rational for him to avoid one while embracing the other. And finally, simply to distinguish this case dealing with a sentencing issue from the differentiating between the 4 and the 3-point enhancement, this court's statements and the discussion in Melendez illustrates that type of case that would require a 4-point upward enhancement in which there's a large-scale operation involving the resale of drugs and hierarchical control. And if the court has no questions, I would like to rest. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ford. And thank you very much to you, to your co-counsel, Ms. Schrupp. Thank you for Northwestern taking the case. I assume that Chicago Kent passed on the opportunity to represent its graduate in this court. The case is taken under advisement.